Hey listeners, and welcome to another episode of Talks with Treshane, where we delve into the morality of controversial topics. In the last episode, we talked about euthanasia, and today we'll be continuing the euthanasia series with episode 2.
I agree. Now, to address what you were saying about how the closeness of a person grants them the authority to allow doctors to euthanize their patients. So what I think is the person isn't in a state where they can give consent to die. But if we see that they are going to die anyways, or if you see that they are going through prolonged suffering
and
not making any significant progress, right. I think it would be best to just, I don't want to sound insensitive, but take them out of their misery, just cut them, just be done with it.
But
right?
You know what I also think is in relation to persons in vegetative states, it is not cheap to have someone on life support to be on a ventilator.
Right.
Especially look at your surroundings, look at what's happening in the world right now. And in the initial cases of corona, about 6 months in, 9 months in, there in Jamaica there are only what, 3 ventilators, and literally you need that to live, and it is not cheap. And what about the third world countries?
So that would also factor in, should I give the doctor to go ahead to let this, to release my spouse, my sibling, my father from this suffering? Because every day, every hour, every minute that person is on life support, is on that ventilator, that is hundreds of thousands of dollars in medical debt, and that is a great factor. I know a lot of people don't like to say, I don't like to talk about money and medical care, but we need to talk about it, because that really plays a great part in health and in euthanasia. Because if you look around in your community today and look at private doctors versus public clinics, which one is more crowded?
Trish. Mm-hmm. We're looking at the financial side, but what about the mental and emotional side? How many of us are strong enough? Can honestly say we are strong enough to deal with a family member in a vegetative state from day to day, catering to that person's every need and doing what it takes to take care of that person, provide him or her with care.
It is mentally exhausting, because imagine someone you love for, you care for, is in such a state and you really cannot do anything about it, and you have to come to the hospital every day and you have to see them making no progress. That is very taxing on someone's mental health and mental ability.
Exactly.
And emotional stableness, and that might even have them in the hospital being treated for certain things, you know,
like high blood pressure.
Right.
And while I do agree that it's a hard decision to make to kill, quote unquote, kill your family member, mm-hmm. it is an even harder decision to choose to live with that burden, that financial burden,
right.
that mental burden, that
emotional.
You're
burden.
Basically watching them die before your eyes.
And I do. You see, when persons are put in certain situations, the decision they make, I would never judge them, because I cannot imagine being in their financial, mental, and emotional position, having to watch the person you love, you grew up loving, dwindle down to nothing. You get me? So any decision, whether it is morally right, I understand. If I can see through it, I will understand why you made that decision. And you know that there are many arguments for and against euthanasia. And I have some of them right now. So, and the arguments for and against, they also bring up some very tough questions that we as people have to answer. So, persons who support euthanasia contend that in some ways, allowing someone to die is more humane than forcing them to endure the constant pain caused by a chronic medical condition for which there is no treatment or cure, which we were talking
and
about.
And I agree. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And dying with dignity is also an important consideration for these patients, which we both agree on. And to some of them, choosing death is a human right. So that would answer the question or give some insight to the question, do individuals have the right to choose when and how they die? And having the
and if we look at it, you know, if you look at it, we don't have the right, or we don't have the decision to choose whether we are born or not. So why can't we have decision on when we die?
Right, because it's a process, you know, we don't know when we start. So how should we, or what gives us the right to say, okay, here is where it ends? And having the autonomy to decide mm-hmm. the timing and method of their deaths would make the dying process much more quote-unquote predictable and respectable, preventing them from succumbing to tormenting deaths with unnecessary prolongation of pain. And I had to say quote-unquote predictable and respectable because in some parts of the world, having a natural pain-filled death is looked up upon because you are strong enough to finish your race to the end and not having to have other methods to fasten it or to hasten the speed.
But does that mean we judge persons who decide to drop out of their race prematurely?
That is true, and that I remember.
Why do we always have to glorify suffering?
You know, that is a very good question.
We always need to glorify suffering.
Why do we glorify suffering? And it is very prominent in today's society. Let me go off on a small tangent here. Have you ever realized that, especially on social media such as Clubhouse, Twitter, Instagram, even Facebook, everybody wants to be a hustler? Yes, everybody wants to be a hustler.
Girl.
Everybody wants to be working from their 16 and have this and get a bag and whatever. But you have to look at it that some of us, our parents were hustlers and they provided certain things for us, so things might not be as hard. And we are looked down upon, they are looked down upon because their parents went out and hustled for them. And not everybody has a hustler spirit. Not everybody has to be a business owner or invest in certain things. You get me? And I do feel like that facilitates the glorification of suffering. All right, so back to Nigeria.
Yes, because they are, hold on, before you go back, because they are basically saying, they're basically making it look as if those who are not quote-unquote hustling, they are not doing anything really, when they aren't even, some of them aren't even promoting healthy or progressive hustling. They're promoting this toxic hustle mentality where if you get 9 hours of sleep, you're lazy. If you don't stay up all night, you're lazy. If you find time to take care of yourself, you're lazy. Which is just glorifying that, oh, in order to get something good out of life,
you have to be working yourself to the bone. And I realize that a lot of people love to cling to the ghetto youth narrative. Everybody is a ghetto youth and we're striving to come out of the ghetto, blah, 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 blah. And
I know why that is so. Because it makes their story seem more relatable.
Everybody wants to be the underdog in the quote-unquote race, whatever this is.
Like, it's okay if you did not suffer for your childhood. It's okay if you weren't from the ghetto. It's okay if your parents made sure that you had it. There's no, there's no shame in that. Why suddenly there's a shame in your parents taking the stone before?
There's no clear-cut way to success. I can come out of the ghetto and I can work hard day and night and be successful, and you can live uptown and go to certain schools and have certain facilities and you be successful and we're both successful and the society is better. So I do feel like we should not glorify suffering. Stop. Right. And the third argument for euthanasia is
oh my god, we just jump back in.
Is that euthanasia advocates and emphasizes that the quality of life can only be assessed, this is the important part, assessed by the individual him or herself, and it is completely impossible for anyone else to fully comprehend the feeling of the individual. And I feel like this speaks to persons who push against physician-assisted suicide, where the person is in a coma, a vegetative state, and they cannot choose for themselves. So this is basically saying that if I cannot choose, you should not choose for me, because at the end of the day, this is my life and this is my decision to make. So I feel
I agree that
is something that we should consider. We as humans having the tough conversations to consider.
So how would persons unjustify euthanasia?
I'm not sure if you know, but patients, they have to sign this, is it an ode or a right? I'm not sure what it is called.
It's called the, hold on.
It is basically a right where they say that they cannot harm the patients that they are taking care of, right? And is taking
it's a Hippocratic
out of their misery harm? Did you find what the name was?
Yeah, it's a Hippocratic oath.
Yes, a Hippocratic oath. That is it. So. That is also a question. Do doctors, providing that they have to take the oath, would that bar them from taking methods of euthanasia, such as passive euthanasia, which is an excess of support? Is that a method in which would condone or not condone doctors facilitating euthanasia?
Alright, so one of the promises within the oath is first to do no harm. But when you look at euthanasia, is it really harm that they're bringing to the patient or extracting the patient out of harm?
Right, but you also have to look at the flip side, because it is a very slippery slope. If the doctor can say, yes, I am taking... this, I am making the call because I don't want to see my patient in suffering. I am making the call to go against the oath and perform euthanasia. Who is to say that the doctor is not breaking any other oaths, such as drinking on the job, smoking on the job, not washing your hands properly before surgery, not changing your protective equipment? So I do feel like when that oath is broken, also the trust in the doctor and the hospital as a whole is broken, because who is to say that you have done other things that can, which is in your eye for the greater good, but also leads to bad things happening? So I do feel that we should consider that side with the argument.
Why do we have to look at it? Why do we have to look at it from a black and white perspective, right? It says do no harm. What harm does it really do? For example, a child who has brain cancer, right? They've done all the chemotherapy, they've done all the necessary treatments, transplant, whatever they have to do to make the child better. However, the child continues to deteriorate. They have no hope. They're going to die in about a month. However, the child is in immense pain. They can't eat. They can't take themselves to the bathroom. They can't talk. They can barely see, can't hear. What harm does it do to subtract the child from that situation?
Right.
The oath is do no harm. How is the oath being broken if the child is subtracted from a situation that causes
And that is the issue with the greater good. That is really the issue with the greater good, because it is based on perspective. It is based on perspective. And you know, there are people in the world that are strictly against euthanasia, and look at it from a black and
white perspective. Yeah, that's where moral subjectivity comes in.
And we have to, as people, we have to respect the decisions of others, no matter how far out and wrong it may seem to us. We have to respect it. And speaking of brain cancer, this is another argument against euthanasia. So determining a patient's mental capacity and competence can be tricky, which we already know, and especially in cases where the patient's medical condition has already affected brain function. And studies have shown that patients with depression are more likely to request for euthanasia as an alternative form of suicide. So we also have to look at that point. Because remember, when you have cancer and you are going through chemotherapy, I'm not sure if you know, but a nausea is a side effect, and they have prescription anti-nausea pills that they give to specifically chemo patients, and one side effect of that is depression, and that can cloud the patient's judgment. So they can say, "Oh, doctor, I cannot go on any further. Just perform the task.
All right. So when we look at that, what percentage of those requesting to be euthanized can be diagnosed with some mental disorder such as depression? What percentage for us to come to that conclusion that persons who are requesting euthanasia, or a majority of persons who are requesting euthanasia, they aren't in the mental capacity to do so?
But the problem with that is that you can never quantify feelings. That is one of the issues. If I am depressed, I have anxiety, I have paranoia, you cannot say, okay, on a scale of 1 to 10, depression is 7 today, anxiety is 3 today. It's just not one of those things that you can use statistics.
I agree.
To judge. So we still come back to that problem, and I'm not sure of, I don't know. It's really a situation thing, and it has to do with the person in the moment and the doctor. Because, you know, we have not considered the doctor and what they might be going through, having this patient for how many years, trying to treat them, wanting to take the patient out of the misery, but also not wanting to break the oath, because this oath is a very serious thing amongst medical societies, and one slip up could really cost you your job. And we know that, especially in Jamaica, it is not easy to become a doctor, because the years of medical schools and the internships and the cost of schooling, it is really not easy. And I do feel like it is important to consider the doctor's point of view when thinking of whether to euthanize or not. Right?
We have come to the end of part 2 of our euthanasia series. If you're enjoying the discussion, find part 3 on our profile to pick up where we left off. See you there!